Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, you're welcome along to a very special Wednesday Night Rugby. As usual, Keith Wood is alongside me. Good evening, Keith. Hello.
Good evening. How are you, Joe?
Very well, very well. I am happy to say we have a special guest for this evening. He played just the 139 times for Australia between 94 and 07. He is a World Cup winner. He is legendary in his field. George Gregan, all the way from Australia. Good evening to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on the show. Looking forward to it.
So, Keith, would you open the contacts book and drag this fella along, I suppose, for the evening? That's the plan.
Well, I did. I mean, I know George forever. I think at this stage we both started around the same time, back in the early 90s. But I think latterly, since we've retired, we've become part of a alternative whiskey club where every time we meet, it's the whiskey club is now open. You know, so it's it's one of those kind of lovely things that you get to know guys that you play against. You don't like them, you do like them, kick that out of each other, but when you stop playing, you get a chance to have a chat. And we meet up every time we can. So all the matches that happened in the autumn, but World Cup Tokyo, we had a howl in Tokyo for the World Cup. It was fantastic. So it's great to have him back out on air, you know.
George, where in Australia are you at the moment?
In Sydney, sort of. I've been living in Sydney since 96, grew up in Canberra, went to school, university. My parents still live there, but been in Sydney since 96, so Sydney's home for me at the moment. And I guess we'll get into it, but it's going into Easter. Good time of year wise in April in Sydney, but it's totally different to what we're seeing. I guess that's everywhere around the world due to what we're dealing with, the pandemic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere in the world is struggling, to say the least. But Australia, when you throw in the fires on top of everything, has been through the ringer in a big way. What a year.
Yeah, it has been. Like, it's been an incredible 12 months, but particularly through the summer period. It went from just incredible droughts. I remember Woody mentioned it earlier. We obviously caught up during Rugby World Cup. I remember doing an event with some of the Aussie farmers, and they were talking about, normally they're really positive farmers. They expect the rain, the drought will break. But they were 3.5 years into it, and it was like, we just don't know when it's going to end. And then on top of that, we had the bushfires, and then we had these ridiculous rains afterwards as well, which caused flooding. So it went from one extreme. One week they were shutting down towns and getting people to evacuate because of the chance of fire, and then they go back into their homes because they've beaten that natural disaster and they get flooded. So it was a really crazy time. And then obviously you roll into what we're doing, the world's dealing with now, but it's been an incredible 12 months. You know, where we live in Sydney, like sometimes the visibility of all the places, Canberra, where I grew up in, that was at times the world's worst quality air. It's normally the cleanest air in the world. So that gives you an example of just how much the fires are having an impact on this country.
So you said there's drought for the last 3.5 years in the build-up to the fires.
Yeah, it has been. It's been bone dry. It's been, and that's obviously the worst mix. You go into a drought. There's obviously a 3.5 year drought. There's a lot of fuel, which is obviously the trees, the dry fuel, the dry shrubbery, and then you add extreme heat, which we had. Like, it was just unprecedented how hot the summers were, and then it just takes a few, which occurred. Some of them were man made, which is really disappointing. Were caused by people, but it's a terrible mix of lots of fuel. Lots of extreme heat, and then the big thing was the change of winds. Like, even in Sydney, as I said, the visibility sometimes was you couldn't see past your face, so to speak, to be fair. And then the southerly would blow in from, and they would change the visibility, but it would actually change the direction of the fire. So there was no let up in the fire. There may have been let up in the visibility and the air quality, but there was no let up in the fires because of this change of wind direction, which was just causing havoc for all the fire people around our country who were just amazing what they did. It was just a relentless summer for Australia.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like it. yeah, I presume that has prompted a hell of a discussion around climate change. I mean, you down there, you guys seem to be at the front line of it.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely caused a lot of discussion, and you know, it causes a lot of heated debate, but the reality around the world is there's something's happened. You just look at for what we've just experienced over this summer period and the build-up to it and the impact it's having in other parts of the world. I went to Zambia years ago with the family in 2012 and did a few things in Livingston Rugby Club. We set up a little foundation there. Well, not a foundation, a club, literally a rugby club. You like this footy. Hopefully gets you there to do a week's coaching with the kids. You just teach them how to play rugby, tag rugby. They all play football. You teach them to play rugby, so it's quite an unusual thing to do. You get them to throw the ball backwards, to run forwards. You do that instinctively when you learn the game of rugby, but if you're coaching it to kids who've never done it before, it's an interesting phenomenon. But they pick it up really quick because it's games and it's fun. But cutting to Livingston and Zambia up is it's Victoria Falls. Like it's always, even in the dry season, there's water going over. It was bone dry. Like there's no water on the Zambezi River flowing over Victoria Falls, and that gives you a real big, visual example of how the impact of, global warming is having. If there's no water in Victoria Falls, that's quite incredible.
Yeah. Keith, you've often been on the show down the years and talked about the admiration you have for Australian rugby played at its best. So talk to us about where George Gregan fits into all that.
Yeah, he doesn't fit into it at all. what I loved with so I got my first test against Australia in 1994. I think George got his first test a few weeks either before or after. I can't remember.
Yeah, that's it. 94. Exactly.
And it wasn't just. They didn't have a huge number of players because everybody would always go for the comparison and say, well, obviously you need to follow the All Blacks because they have got such an inherent sense of skill and they've got this conveyor belt of players that are coming through. Australia and rugby, and we'll talk about how rugby is struggling in Australia, and it is really struggling at the moment, but it's fourth or fifth sport, very similar to rugby in Ireland. So that's where the similarities are. Some of the great athletes go and play in other sports, for rugby in particular, Gaelic football. Some of the guys, you just love to take some of the greats from Gaelic football and to manoeuvre them over into a rugby backline. But it's the use they make of their player. If they have a player who's a really good player, even if he isn't in the right position, it doesn't seem to matter to Australia. They'll always get the best players onto the field. And I always liked that. There was an interchangeability about it. Not with George as a nine. And George was a world-class nine from pretty much the first days he started playing. But all the other players moved across the back line. So your players played at 10 or 15 or 12. Or Matt Gitto played at 9, 10 and 12. And, you know, so suddenly you had this ability to make certain that you had players who were leaders, who could understand the game incredibly well, really good footballers, would be able to pull the rabbit out of a hat because they were just, they got all their class players on the field. So if they had two guys, so I often thought about it, the Ward, Tony Ward and Ollie Campbell conversation that used to happen over out halves in the late 70s in Ireland, they would never have been playing or fighting with each other. They would always have been on the same team in Australia because they didn't want to have made certain they get the good guys on the field. And I just thought, because the amount of players that Australia had, that they were the ones that we should follow. They were smart. They played smart rugby a lot of the time. And I think partly as well to do with the Australian Institute of Sport back in that particular period of time, they were ahead of the game in an awful lot of physiological sides and we weren't. And I thought for us, they were the ones to go and look at it. But look, I grew up and I was fortunate to play against some of them. I grew up watching Lina and Campisi and they were just phenomenal players. Then played against them at the end of their career. But there never seemed to be a big fall off in Australia in that period of time. So they had a great team. And as soon as that great team were gone, you had Georgie, you had Larkham, you know, you had Timmy Horn and Little, and there was just so many players of huge quality that would just consistently came through and stayed for 10 years. They rarely had players who came and played really well for a year or 2 years. They kept them for 10 years. They seemed to get the best and exact the most out of all their top players.
George, we know the career you went on to have, and you burst on the scene with the Jeff Wilson tackle in 94. I think that was your fourth test.
Yeah, it was.
Were you hot stuff as a youngster coming through when you were 17, 18, 19? Were you earmarked to go on to great things?
I'd have to be saying no. I honestly think I was one of those guys. I was always small, so that never changed. throughout my whole life. But from about under-16s, so under-16s, you got your rep teams under-10s through to about the age bracket. I think it's everywhere. But from about under-15s, I struggled to make starting rep teams. I'd make the squad, but I wasn't the starting halfback. I started playing halfback from about under-14s, but up until then I was a fly half, so I was playing number 10. And so I enjoyed it, but I was probably, to be fair, at that stage of my life, I was really focused on cricket. I just love cricket. I actually had a podcast the other day with a guy called Shane Lee, who played Australia in Test cricket, but also one day as he won a World Cup in 99, and his brother's Brett Lee, who was a wonderful fast bowler for our country. And I used to play against him at that age, that's under-16s through to under-19s. And my big focus was cricket. I wanted to sort of try and, you know, become an Australian cricketer and play with the likes of Ricky Ponting and the Adam Gilchrist. But when I played against them, I realised I was never going to be that calibre. That was so good. But I played rugby as well because it was a winter sport. And then I always thought, well, maybe I wasn't big enough, or maybe I just didn't get the opportunity that I would have liked. But I still loved the game of rugby. And then when I left school, I went to my local club, and then, you know, you're playing a bit of Colts, which was under-19s, under-20s at that stage. We had a good year, had a fun year. Like, we had a good time off the field, and we ended up winning the competition. So it was kind of nice. And then before you know it, you sort of get I got offered a scholarship, not for cricket, but for rugby union when I was about 18 or 19. And that's probably when I started thinking, hang on, I should take this seriously, because, you know, not many people are getting scholarships, particularly out of Canberra. And I got a chance living in Canberra. The Australian Institute of Sport was in Canberra, so I got the best access to all those facilities, the best coaching. I really applied myself, which is what I had to do to give it a crack, because that's probably what I was trying to do with cricket. But it ended up being rugby, which I love. I always loved rugby, but someone saw something in me, and before you know it, you get an opportunity. You're playing sevens in 93, 94, making Australian sevens team. I go to Hong Kong in 94. Bob Dwyer sees something in me at the Hong Kong sevens, but Glenn Ell was my coach, and Glenn Ell was the backs coach for the Wallabies in that period. So someone takes a punt on a youngster. I think we've all had it. It would have been the same with Woody. He may have been a star from the time he was probably 12, I reckon. but I definitely was more focused on cricket at that stage in my career. It's quite funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Funny, I'm just laughing. I started scrum half and out half, and it's where I played until I was 16, and didn't play a huge amount in school. Actually, I stopped because I was so small, and only started back again at 16 or 17. And when all those representative things kind of go to happen in school, we had Munster schools trials and Ireland schools trials when I was 16, 17, but I was playing hurling for Clare instead. And that was the end of my hurling, as it turned out. And I only really started, and I loved rugby in school, and I loved it in the last year of school. But it's when you start afterwards. So I joined again Colts, under-19s, under-20s, playing for Gary Owen. And my first coach was Paddy Reid, who had won the Grand Slam in 1948, a 40-year ban for playing rugby union. He was my first coach. And it is about finding somebody who says he's got something a little bit different. Let's pick him. Yep. Let's give him a start and see what happens.
Mm.
Yeah, that's it.
George, if we draw a line to start with from, say, 94 through to 99, you come on the scene, you know, the Jeff Wilson tackle is a nice way to announce yourself. You get the 95 World Cup thrown in there, which is historic and iconic and memorable for all sorts of reasons. And then you go and win the World Cup in 99 under Rod McQueen. Must be thinking to yourself, this is pretty sweet, isn't it? Is it always going to be like this? This is amazing stuff. That's kind of a magical introduction to national rugby.
It was a magical start, to be fair. Like, I was on the bench for the two games against Ireland in 94 when Woody played. And then I got my start playing against Italy. And then we played Samoa after we played Ireland. And then obviously my fourth test was the All Blacks. And then the next time, the following year, it's World Cup in South Africa. We're playing the first game against the hosts, and they end up becoming the world champions. But we lose that game. We went in as very strong favourites because the team had won in 1991. So I was part of a wonderful team. You mentioned some of the names, Tim Horans, Jason Littles, Rob McQueen, Rob McCalls. You had Ewan McKenzie. Gosh, you had Campo. It was such an amazing team who'd won in 91. And there was still a core of those guys in that squad, and there's some young players coming through, like the Matt Burks. There was like Scott Bowen, myself, Daniel Herbert, Joe Ross. But we failed in that World Cup. So we went from hero to zero very quickly. You learn that really quickly. You learn that in sport. But I hadn't lost a test until that first game in Cape Town. So I think I played 6 test matches with the Wallabies or whatever, and we'd won every single test match. So that was my first loss, and it was a terrible feeling, but that was the reality of my start. It was probably too good a start. Like, sport brings you back to reality really quickly. And then between 95 and 99, it sounds like everything tracked really well. We got our bums kicked a heap of times, that Wallaby team. I remember the All Blacks were like a little toy doll for them, as a cat, like a kitten playing with a toy doll or something. That's what we were from about 96, 97. We were on and off against the Springboks. We could beat them at home, but we couldn't beat them away. And we were very inconsistent. And then Rod McQueen came in at the end of 1997. We went on a tour to Argentina. I think we lost a test match there for the first time since 1970-something, and we were the worst Wallaby team ever since then. And to think from that moment to 99, November, we become world champions, it does, if you look at it, just looking at the stats, like, it looks as though it was a pretty smooth ride. We actually went through some hard times. I remember being on the end of like a 40-point hiding against the Springboks in Pretoria, and that was in 1997. So, no, there was a lot of learnings. There's a lot of dark moments for that team, but we came through. The strength of that squad was we were quick learners, and we really cared for each other, and we worked hard, good coaching from Rod McQueen and coaches around, but really, really drove the leaders to drive the team. And Woody knows all about that. He's been part of some very successful teams, and that's really, really important. And then a crux of that team stayed together post that 99 campaign. So we'd had some bad times, but you have to do that to enjoy the good times. Otherwise, it's not as enjoyable. It's not as rewarding. But that was reality. Yeah,
I've seen you talk about what McQueen brought to the setup and or the secret to that World Cup win, the win against France in the final ultimately, and you used the phrase consistency of thought. You might explain what that means in that Australian context.
Yeah, well, we spoke about that a lot. I think, you know, it'll be interesting to hear Woody, because he was part of, like, I thought that Lions team in 2001, I watched them in 1997, they definitely were another great team which inspired us as well, in terms of being able to take your game away from home. I think if you want to be a great team, you can be a good team, but if you want to be a great team, you've got to be able to take your game away from where you're comfortable, and more often than not, you're comfortable in your own backyard. So if you can win away from where you're comfortable, then you're well and truly on the path to being a very, very good team, potentially a great team. And you have to be consistent. And that consistency of thought, I think, provides consistency of action, consistency of your habit. Does it guarantee success? No, it doesn't. But I tell you what, you're going to be in the wrestle more often than not. And that was, I think, what that team was. We won a lot of test matches in that period by very narrow margins. It wasn't necessarily because we were more highly skilled or better prepared or whatever it was, but we were very consistent in terms of how we trained and were prepared for those moments, and we look forward to them. I think that's another thing. I want to hear that from Woody too, because I think you look forward to those pressure moments, because that's what it's all about. And that was definitely the hallmark of the success of that team. Was very consistent in how we went about those moments and how we prepared for them.
I found playing against that particular Australia team, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, I played a few tests and lost all of them, apart from the first Lions test in 2001. I've never felt as much pressure in a game as I did in those games, because I felt I'm not saying that you knew everything that we knew, but ye seem to be a step ahead an awful lot of the time. From the forwards' perspective, you didn't have a good scrummaging pack. I mean, you were poor scrummaging pack, but you were magnificent cheaters in the scrum. And your ability to drop a scrum and tie your shoelaces is kind of like a throwback to
clean the boots.
You know, it was like, but it was amazing, because you'd get hammered in the scrum, and then for some very strange reason, you'd get totally in the top in one or two scrums in the whole game. It was as if you knew you could only focus on a couple. But in the lineouts, was for me, I found it was horrendous, with Ilsey in the second row, and a lot of the time not being lifted at all. He would jump on his own, so you'd lift the other two guys at the front and the back, and you're like threading a needle to try and find
your way.
I psychologically for me, that was where I was always at my most vulnerable, was against Australia in trying to thread that needle. And I always felt you were so entirely, I thought you were really well coached in that period of time, but I thought as a group of players, you seemed to be incredibly focused all the time. So you played so simplistically, so well all the time. And you call it down as that consistency. I just didn't think you made an awful lot of mistakes at the stage. Like, I give an example. I lost three lineouts, I think it was, in the World Cup in 99 against Australia. I could have lost 12. I mean, you were an inch away from nearly every single ball in the lineout. And all I was thinking when I was going up to the lineout was, this is not where I want to be. You know, if I could have been anywhere else, I just felt that the amount of pressure you were putting as a team on different players in different situations was pretty extraordinary. And even when you play badly, I felt you were always in a position to win a match. You stayed in the games until the last 10 minutes. And you had the ability then of players to do something magic. But I looked at that Lions tour in 2001, a couple of weeks ago. Joe Roth was magnificent. I mean, absolutely stunning. Larkham just coasted around the field for he really struggled in the first test. He was really poor in the first test, and then in the latter two tests, he just did whatever he felt like doing.
Yeah. But you know what's funny about looking at that too, Woody, was just the speed. Like I know the game, the modern game is fast and you can never compare it. But I've seen that series and it was played at incredible speed and intensity and just the skill. It was quite an amazing, like you look back on it, because I think it's interesting when you're in the moment, because there's three big test matches over consecutive weeks, you got to have a short-term memory because you got to dust that off and move on. But over time, you look back on it and you go, wow, that was some series. Like, and it's just moments. It's little moments. Like, I think we were on our knees in that second test just before halftime. I think you guys were nearly about to score. And then it just, the ebb and flow of that series was, and the players, it was amazing. You know, we get to catch up at over the World Cups. You see those guys and obviously we get on right now, but they're epic battles and just, played at an incredible intensity and a really high skill level, I thought. It was a pleasure to be part of that series. And as a player, like, you guys get to, if you're good enough, you get to play on it. Maybe you get to play a couple of times for the Lions or a couple of tours if you're good enough, which you definitely were the case. But for us, it's a once in a career. I talk about Nathan Sharp. Nathan Sharp played over 100 test matches for Australia, but his first test for the Wallabies was 2002. I think his last one was 2012. So he missed the window. He missed his 12-year window by a year on either side. And that's the nature of – that's how special the Lions series was for me, because you don't get to play the Lions. You're lucky to play them in your career, let alone a series like that, which is just epic.
Yeah, it was magic. It was quick. I looked at it the other weekend. I've never watched the games fully through, so – I looked at it. I couldn't get over the scrums. They happened instantaneously.
Yeah.
There were an unbelievable wrestle and hard, but there's no messing around. There was a bit of a smash into it, which we know is dangerous, and that's gone. But I think they could tidy up the scrums an awful lot more. They should be an awful lot faster.
Yeah, and the ball was like, there's this contest, but when the ball was ready to move, we just moved it, didn't we? Both teams, and it was game on. And that was the mindset of both teams. It was pretty special.
Keith, from memory, was there needle between the two teams in that 0-1 series?
Yes. Not a personal needle, really. There was a little bit between Matt Dawson and the plank.
that came from Healy, didn't it? It was that, Dawson, Healy.
Yeah,
Healy. It was more Healy.
Yeah. But so we had a bit of needle. It was a strange tour. So when we went in 97, we were mostly kids. A few guys had toured before, but not a huge amount. Total underdogs. Kind of going to be the end of the Lions, and we win it in South Africa, and that's pretty fantastic. And like, just so far up there on highlight reel, you know, it's brilliant. But then 4 years later, we go, and I felt a lot of the guys who had been in '97 almost took it for granted. that they were there by right. And you just can't do that. You have to prove it every second of every training session and then of every match. And we ended up with a bit of a Deminos and Dirt Trackers part of it. And so yeah. There was some of the bitching that was there. There was a bit of edge. There was also that disgraceful McRae incident on Raj, yeah. Where he pummeled Raj into the ground, which was a disgrace. So there was a bit of edge from that, and there was a bit of edge in the match because we wanted to win.
Sure.
But not an edge, you know, the way you can say, well, yeah, I don't like those guys. That wasn't the attitude. It was, there was a huge amount of respect on that tour. I mean, between two teams, incredible respect from it. And we kicked the crap out of each other for three tests. I mean, it was at a million miles an hour. But I can tell you that 5 minutes after the final, I was having a beer with Foley, Michael Foley. He took some beers, came in and sat down, and we sat down, we had a chat and a beer, because that's what you're supposed to do after it. And it was the lowest I ever felt, losing that series, because I wanted to, we really wanted to win the series. We had a very good team. You had a very good team. We were falling apart by the end, and there's no excuses on any of that, but we were literally held together with string at it. We needed to win the second test because we didn't know whether we had it. And I thought we pulled a huge amount of stops out in the third test, but that wiped the floor with all of us. So I was as low as I could possibly be, I'd say, after that. But it was amazing. And actually, when you look back at it, and it's funny, as you get older, this is, sports fans hate this as a thought, but as you get older, you look and you say, well, you win some and you lose some.
That's it.
And there's two teams involved in them. So it's plus or minus, depending on who you are. And I think if you look back and say that was something that was fantastic, and if you remember how difficult it was, and it was difficult, we were struggling to put players on the field. I still think it's the funniest thing of all time that the sub scrum half in that last test had been on a beer up tour for 3 weeks
before. Andy Nicol, wasn't it?
And the only reason that he actually was on the bench was because they had to breathalyze him to climb the Sydney Harbour Bridge the day before. And that's what we were down to, you know. And it's a very tough thing, but it was I watch it with my sons. That's something now that makes it really nice. I watch it with my sons. They loved it. Standard of rugby, that there was offloads coming from everywhere and it was going a million miles an hour. And it's kind of nice to look back on it. I still wish we bloody won it though.
Yeah, of course. But it's funny, you talk about that moment, like post-game, you're having a few beers with Foles. Like, I remember I kept going out of that change room because of this press and everything. So we left our change room opposite the Lions up, and Jono came out at the same time. He's gutted. We've all been there, those big moments. You want to win them. It's like it's a final. It was a final. And then and we go up and we have a beer together, like we always did, no different at Twickenham or when we played England here in Australia. And we got over it after having a few beers. And then, you know, the next time I saw Jono, I obviously saw him a few times in between at Twickenham and in Australia leading to the 2003 World Cup. You get to the 2003 World Cup final, our next biggest sort of deja vu 2 years later. We leave at the same time. It's quite a funny. And I said, I guess we're not having an after-match function. It was after the final. I said, I guess we would have had a beer together, mate. I guess the flip side this time around, mate, I'm feeling how you did 2 years ago. So that, well done being a world champ type thing. That's how it is. People kind of sometimes don't want to hear those stories, but that's the reality of it. There's a huge amount of respect between two teams, particularly when you get to those moments. They're the highlight of your career. Everything's on the line, but it's a game of rugby, and we're lucky enough to be inside the arena. You never lose sight of that, and you certainly respect the players you're up against, because you're not a mug if you're running out on the field and you're playing against each other. And there's always that deep respect. But as Woody says, and no different to me, you want to win those games. They're the ones. But sports, the way it doesn't allow you always to win. So that's how you deal with it. And I think rugby's great for that. It's a great sport for that.
George, you mentioned 03 there. So Eddie Jones is obviously still a very relevant figure in our lives today and still, making headlines for all sorts of reasons. Tell us about the Jones that you worked under for that 03 World Cup. Was he impressive as a coach? What was his manner? How did he deal with you? Give us a sense of him.
He's impressive. And he's always going to say things which I think are just the wrong moment. And he's done that a few times throughout his career. I know he's done that in the lead up to Six Nations games. But if you got to know, knowing the man, he just really cares for his players. He really cares for his team, and he wants to be the best prepared coach in the world. He wants to learn from the best coach in the world. It could be Bill Belichick, it could be Mourinho, it could be who am I thinking of? Who's at Manchester? Who was Alex Ferguson. But then even now, he was at he's Spanish.
Guardiola.
He's got the beard and everything. Yeah, Guardiola. Remember he did a Guardiola. Went to a session with him when he was coaching at Munich. And he said, I thought I was going, well, this is 2015. He says, but I'm still on training wheels as a coach. I went and saw a session. And what they did in 15 minutes just inspired me in terms of how I want to prepare my players and so on and so forth. So he's always looking at how to improve his program to create the best environment for his players to perform. So that was kind of his mindset. He's obviously a totally different coach. Like he's much better now than he was then, but he was very, very good in 2003. But we prepared for that World Cup campaign very much like, for us, that's like when the World Cup, remember we played Ireland, actually one of the great weekends, a bit of an aside story. So you had the international game, so the Gaelic AFL sort of hybrid game was played, I think, on the Friday night at the stadium we played, which was at that stage, I think it was the Colonial Stadium. The Telstra Stadium. And then we had that afternoon, the next day on the Saturday, they had Derby Day, which is on the last weekend of October. And then that night was our game. And they obviously didn't, they know Aussies drink, but they obviously didn't factor in how much the Irish drink. So Aussies and Ireland together in the same stadium. They ran out of beer before half time in that stadium. And they said this, it's been the biggest weekend ever in Melbourne, but particularly that stadium, they've never had sales like it. And, you know, we prepared that World Cup campaign very much like that race there, Derby Day, is the one before Melbourne Cup. So we approached the World Cup like it was a spring carnival, like we wanted to be preparing. So our big day was hopefully Melbourne Cup. So he was really big on preparing and making sure that we did everything we could so we were going to be peaking at the right time. And, you know, the amount of training, the volume that we did in the lead up to it, we trained really hard like everyone does. Like everyone trains hard before a World Cup. And everyone's in probably their best nick of their career, but he was really, really deliberate, and that really had a big impact on us. So when we got to the year ends, like from Ireland onwards, they were the games we really targeted because they were knockout games for us. It was just making sure we're physically right, so we tapered. So he's very, very clever in that regard, and he has the ability to really push his players and push the best out of his coaches, but he, at the same time, he has that ability to share that vision of what we want to be looking like if we were to get to the big race, so to speak. And that's the hallmark of Eddie. He's one of the best prepared coaches I've ever worked with. He's the best coach I've worked under, but in terms of his preparation, he just never stops learning.
And George, where were you on the field when Johnny Wilkinson drops that ball?
I was yelling, I've got his left foot. I've got his left foot, Georgie, come from the other angle. I was thinking he's going to have his left foot. You'll see me running, and I see the film clip every friggin' World Cup in the lead up to it, don't I, Woody? I'm on the wrong side because the smart ass kicked it on his right boot. Smart ass, he's too good for everyone. No one saw that party trick. That was his special trick. He did it a few times later in his career, but no, he knocked it over on his opposite boot. But he's always set up for that, and that's where I was. So I was running. I was going, oh, shit, he's kicking on his right. I can't get to his right. No,
and would you have had his left covered?
I wouldn't have had it covered. If you set up for it, you would have been dire. Would have made it more difficult, but you weren't even a factor because he just caught him. He was on his right boot, so you're in his periphery. You weren't even in his periphery.
Yeah.
He was dead to me. I was dead to him, so to speak. He was just knocking it over, which he did.
God, that's the genius in that moment of pressure, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That is, and it sounds like that moment, and he would have practiced. You know what he's like with his practice. Would he would have been preparing for that moment, and that was just no. He was ready for it, and he knocked it over as such.
He didn't even know you were there, Georgie. That's the
thing. I know.
The only thing
that's
he
it.
The ball, and he knew he was going to kick it, and it was going over the posts, and
that's it.
Everything he was oblivious to to everything else around him. You know, extraordinary guy, Johnny. Very interesting. There's a madness in the amount of work he's put into his game, and he's very interesting to to try and get him very when you get him in a quiet spot to have a chat about it and just to go through it. It is all those real greats, all those guys that have those huge moments and they've practiced so much, there is a madness to that brilliance too, you know?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, Kearnsy and I caught up with him in 2015 at the World Cup in England. And it was just good. Like, we got him in one of those quiet moments, and he was just so happy to see us and just so happy to break bread and have a nice meal. And we didn't talk too much about rugby. It was just a bit of everything. Yeah, he's a quality guy. And you could just see you'd love him to be doing more of that, just catching up with, which I think is special about our sport.
Yeah.
George, we had Owen Redden on the show last week, who predominantly obviously played here in Ireland, but was over at Wasps as well for a period in his career, and is of the scrum half cohort. And he was, you know, he's very interesting on a few things which you'd be able to maybe give your perspective on. So he was saying when he plays rugby in Ireland, there was just an expectation that he would just pass the ball, pass. That was what we seemed to want. Whereas if he did that at Wasps, he'd be in the dressing room at halftime and they'd be saying, you haven't made one single break. You're offering no threat. Like, what are you doing? And he also talked about how when he went onto the pitch, he primed himself in effect to just react to what was going on. You know, he's the first point of contact with the ball. He has to take each game almost on its merits, the pace, the tempo, what's going on. And he talked about getting into that kind of calm mindset as opposed to going out to impose himself on a game, which I thought was really interesting. He's another thoughtful character. So the two questions tied into one are the Wasps Ireland thing. What were the expectations on you as an Australian scrum half, and what was your mindset across those 139 tests?
Yeah, it changed, but it stayed the same in many ways. Like, I remember Bob Dwyer blowing up one stage early in my career. Because, like, you've got Michael Liner outside you as a halfback. You want to deliver to your 10 or your first receiver. That could be a running forward. It could be your fly half. It could be someone on the short side. Campese used to call for the ball a lot. So if he called it, he always wanted it. So you've got to have that ability to play it. But you also got to see what's around you. And if there's no one, sort of what we call the pillar 10, 20, 30, a defender around the ruck, if there's space there, you take it. I remember a few times I was passing because I was getting overcalled by, maybe it was Noddy on one side, I had Camp on the other side, and then they're demanding the ball, but there's an opportunity for me and I didn't take it. So Bob Dwyer at halftime gives me a ball and he built up that Wasp. He says, where's the space, blah, 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 and take the space. That's a G-rated version of what he said to me. And so there's always that expectation that you need to run when the space is there and take it and follow your instincts. So I think as a nine, watching a Farr Jones and a Peter Slattery, they were great halfbacks in Australian rugby. They had that ability to be really quick off the deck, but if there's a chance for them to run, they took that space with their legs. That's how I like to play. And then obviously as the game evolved and teams got really good at defending, rugby league had a big impact. I remember that Lions team and that English team over that period, and also all the teams got really good at setting up their defence. And so if you were just passing as a halfback, those first three defenders didn't have any decisions to make. And a lot of the time, particularly under fatigue, those first three defenders are often tight forwards, or they're people who don't want to be having a halfback bouncing out, asking questions of them with running threats around them. So you could pick them off. So there's a real opportunity for you to ask questions around there. Then you start defending outside that. That was how we just worked really closely. Not giving secrets away, it's nothing new. But often outside those forwards, you've got backs. And we used to call that a transition zone where the backs and the forwards are defending. And if you're asking questions of the forwards, then that transition zone becomes quite loose. And we really attack that pretty hard. And once they start tightening up through there, then that's when you release it. So it's just a simple, you're just mixing it around depending upon how the team and the speed of ball. So that was kind of it. I hope that's not too complicated. It's pretty simple. Like, wherever the space was, you took it. You'd either with your legs, and if someone's demanding it, like I had a saying, and I always said that with even now when I coach a bit, like if the 10 or the blind winger or the fullback on the other side of the ruck is demanding the ball, they get it. It comes off the deck. And if you don't give it off the deck and they give you a bollocking, then you cop it. It's time to leave it off the deck. But if you see the space and you feel the space and you know it's there in terms of around the edge of the ruck, and they don't react off you and they're not hitting holes around the transition zone, then you give them a kick up the butt. So it sort of works that way. So that was kind of how I always played. I always talk about you got to have a 9-10, you've got obviously got your fullbacks and your back three and your centres. They're ball players, but particularly at the source around the ruck, there's ball playing opportunity for a nine. There's always ball playing one or two passes out. But if there's a ball playing opportunity and you operate off the nine, then you've got to react off the nine. And everyone just plays off him. And it's simply, so then you've pretty much got 80% of the field covered when you attack. That's nothing. There's no rocket science to it, but that's a good attack. And you see that with good teams. There's a threat around the nine. There's always a threat around, you know, I see him in the background there. Johnny Sexton's, your 10s, your 12s, you've got a good fullback, blind winger who can be on the other side of the ruck. There's threats everywhere. And then you always, then you add in running forwards. It becomes tough to defend. Even if you go to the video, if you get a good quick ball and you've got the ability to play across those sort of pivots, it's hard to defend.
Mm. Were you generally a confident type? Because everything you're talking about there, I can imagine if you're on your game and feeling good about yourself and life and walking onto the pitch with an air of authority, I would say you're making those decisions instinctively, quick as you like. If you're not in the best frame of mind, that could all get a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, it can. Like, it's like anything, I reckon. You ask a golfer, look at Rory McIlroy, how well he hits the ball. There's sometimes he doesn't know where his driver's going, not too many times when I watch him, but you get comfortable and you want to get to that place as much as you can. You want to be able to correct it, fix it. So for me, and for me, my bread and butter, it'd be interesting what Woody has to say, because I've been talking for too much now, but as a half, your bread and butter is your passing. So you want to get back to that. So if you're dropping your confidence, just get the ball out of your hands, hit your target, get that, and then all of a sudden you're away. The skill set for the back line starts with you, really does. That's a big responsibility for a nine. So get that bread and butter right. Then all of a sudden you find your rhythm. Then all of a sudden, okay, my bread and butter's pretty good. We're away. There's a flow, the speed of ball. Then all the other things, then your instincts start taking over. So I think that's always a good, always pass that on to young people when, at a young age, and even when I'm coaching at a high level, I'll just say, just trust your instincts, get back to your basics. And that was no different for me. Like, you're not always going to play perfect. You're going to make some mistakes. I threw plenty of bad passes. I'm sure Steve Larkin, I know he coaches down, so he could probably clarify a lot of those. But you just got to get back on the horse, and then you find your rhythm.
Yeah, I think there's different players and different times too. I think there's a lot less space now in the manner of which the defences are set up. There is very little space that you can take when you're picking the ball up from a ruck now at nine. I think that's kind of cut down a lot. It was funny, you play with Peter Stringer and we talk about Irish scrum halves passing. Well, Peter Stringer running into contact wasn't of much value, you know, and so he didn't do it. And he gave a great line to me once. He said, Woody, once you call for the ball, the decision is made for me. I don't have to think about it. If you make a mess of it, that's your fault. You know, I've given you the ball, you've called for it, you get it. You know, and that's it. And you want him to trust the fact that if you make the call, you get the ball. And that's where I get annoyed with people who call all the time. They're always talking, and you see it when you talk to kids, and you see kids doing it. You see a winger who's 50 yards away for the ball calling for the ball.
It's true.
It's not going to happen. It doesn't. It, like, all you're doing is annoying everybody inside you, you know. And so it's about trying to make the right call at the right time. And you want that link between 9 and 10 all the time, that works. But equally well, we tend to fight for the ball and go and play it. And Conor Murray has been coming under a bit of grief for this. The manner in which you played nine was you'd pick the ball up at pace. You were very, very fast around it, but you would run laterally a lot to find the space, to find a gap, to find a hole for somebody to run into. And you were quite willing to take it into contact yourself then if you didn't, not that you wanted to do it, but, you know, and we tend not to do that so much at nines in Ireland. We don't tend to be, we give out, he'd get a bollocking. Oh, look, he's running across the field. Well, actually, if somebody else makes the gap and he doesn't, that's the right thing to do. So look, I love listening to to playmakers, what they were doing, what their thought process was, and for me the view always was, and I wasn't a playmaker, but the view for me was I wanted to make life easier. So you kind of take a picture of the defense before you call for the ball, so you actually know where everybody is in a general sense, and then you know where you're almost instinctively running into a gap as to where it is. Because you want it a bit easier. That's you don't want to be smashed up all the time.
Yeah, and off the back of that too, Woody, is you're spot on. There's people in you who just call for the sake of calling, like that young winger who's calling it from 50, and you're saying you call it. When you call it, like, you need it because you're in a better position than me. And so there becomes that understanding with players. And, you know, like a lot of my running forwards are much like you. We never played with you, but it would have been one of those ones. But you're calling for it because you're calling for it. You're in space, so you get the ball. So that comes with that. Just comes with combination and playing a lot. But it's a real. It's a really. It sounds really simple, doesn't it? But it's really important to pass on to young people that ability. Call for it when you're in a better position. The person who's got the ball. Otherwise, you're just making noise, and you are. You're annoying the players around you.
A quick last question or two, because we've kept you for long enough. What kind of captain were you? You became captain in 01. What would your teammates say about Gregan, the captain, if we asked them, do you suspect?
I was hard in terms of, I was hard and fair, but also I think I was caring. I was really, it's a good one to ask players, actually, but I demanded a lot of myself, so I demanded a lot of the team. We set a high standard of how we trained, played, and just how we went about things, so I was big on that, but I was also big on, and I learnt this when I first got into the Wallaby team, switch on, switch off. So when we switch on, like be locked in, be ready to go, be it training, be it whatever it was that we need to do as a team. But when it's time to switch off, switch off, like enjoy each other's company, get to know each other. We were really big on, you know, getting out of the hotel when we're on tour and doing things. Like we had plenty of great times where we went to Ireland as a group and made sure that, okay, we did that. Because you can't be thinking of the game all of the time. It just burns you out and you don't enjoy the experiences of what is great about our game. So I'd like to think that, but you should ask some of the guys who are under me. They might tell you a different story, but yeah, that's how I'd like to think I was as a captain.
Yeah. Keith, what would they say about you? I've never asked you that before. Not what would you say about yourself? What would they say about you?
I'd say a bit of a ball breaker, to be honest. It's funny, you look back in it, and there was different times when I was captain as to do different things. I did far too much when I was a young captain. Tried to do everything, made of balls, but, you know, that happens. And you learn from that too. I was lucky enough to get another go at the end of my career. But it's we used to have a different coach every year, so you needed to have a bit of additional discipline or control, which have to say is kind of part of me and isn't part of me in equal measures. So I think when you have more players around you that are senior and have more experience, captaincy becomes an awful lot easier, because when you're trying to be captain just yourself, and this is what you do what I say and everybody does it that way, you're doomed to failure. You know, it needs to be collaborative. You need to trust the players around you. You need to have good leaders at the core positions, 8, 9, 10. Need to be able to think the way around the field. 15, if you're lucky, gives a great view on what's happening on a field. And if you're lucky enough to have characters in those positions, you tend to have a really good team with it. But look, as all captains, I would have done some really good things, a lot of bad things, made loads of mistakes. It's interesting. Captaincy is an interesting concept. I think it's one of those things that is often overrated and often underestimated in almost equal measure.
Yeah, it's true. Well said.
George, on Australian rugby, Keith mentioned we wanted to ask you about this. So we hear bad things and read bad things, and that applies to participation rates, that applies to the numbers watching games in stadiums, and it certainly applies to the financial situation. And that predates the COVID crisis, which I suspect will exacerbate all of that. So the interesting question almost is why has the game struggled in all these areas so acutely over the last decade or 15 years? What's happened?
Yeah, the thing is, like, it's a competitive landscape, but it's always been a competitive landscape. As Keith said at the beginning of the show, we're probably number four as a code in our country, but that hasn't changed. Internationally, one of the strongest. Like, the cricketers, Australian cricket team is probably number one in terms of international exposure. I think the Wallabies, maybe not so much, maybe after the World Cup, even though it was a poor performance, there was still drew a lot of the country behind the Wallaby team. And our soccer team, the Socceroos, get a lot of support as well, particularly if they qualify for a World Cup. It would be probably a cricket, rugby. But the domestic competition, which is our club competition, that's grown over the last 4 or 5 years. So there's a real tribal feel to that, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. So there's rugby supporters there. They're getting 10 to 15,000 turning up to those games. So rugby's strong at that grassroots level, and there is participation. Has it dropped off a little bit? Yes, it has, but it has with, like, AFL, football, and rugby league as well. Same with the viewing, people turning up live. because there's been a big focus for those sports, and a big part of their income is the broadcasting rights, which Australian Rugby doesn't have beyond this year. They're in negotiation. It's a tough time, and it's almost, if something's not done, it's almost going to a point where we've heard commentary around it where they might be able to afford to be paying the players in maybe 5 to 6 months. Just that's the state of the financial sort of a predicament, which is really sad. It almost sends rugby into a semi-amateur period, and to the point where they might need to be bailed out by the government, which has happened. Although I just saw today rugby league, so NRL in our country, they went to some UK banks to get some loans to help them get through this crisis, and then they'll repay them on future earnings once the game comes back online, and they can do that through their television and broadcasting deals. So it's a tough time in for all codes in our country, but rugby has been struggling pre-COVID because of it. And answering your question around what's caused it, there's definitely been inconsistency in how the Wallabies have performed. There's been inconsistency in how Super Rugby teams have performed. And there's just been, there hasn't been consistency, I think, in how the game's been administered and how we want to play in our country. I think that's really critical. These all sound pretty simple solutions, but part of it is the communication and making everyone who's rugby, who loves the game of rugby in our country, feeling part of it. Doesn't matter if it's club rugby, grassroots, that filters into the next level, which might be Super Rugby. And that Super Rugby competition needs to mean something for people, which currently it doesn't, because their teams often go away for 4 weeks. You never see them. And people then, when they come back, they don't know what's going on in the competition. That needs to be revisited. And then there's consistency in how the national team performs, because I think it'd be no different in any country. If your national team's performing well, particularly here in Australia, it does bring people together. So, yeah, that's the state of affairs. I'd like to be more upbeat, almost pretty positive about it, but it has been tough. It's been a tough one to swallow over this last 18 to 24 months especially.
Mm. Right. Keith, any final questions or points you want to make to Mr. Gregan before we let him go?
No, I want a little insight into Stephen Larkham now that he's down in Munster. What are we going to see and expect from him?
Yeah, he's a very intelligent man, very intelligent coach too. It's funny, he was one of those players who played with so much flair and he just looked as though he was playing, the whole saying, playing what's in front of him. He played with freedom, but we played a simple way, but we had a lot of structure around how we played too, which allowed people like him and Ross and others, the Horans, to play with freedom. So he'll be looking to try and coach that way, and I think which will be a really good evolution for him is understanding the conditions that you play in the UK, and that varies depending upon its winter, firmer pitches, being able to adapt. I think that'll be the best evolution for Stevie in terms of his coaching, because he does like his structure. He knows what he wants to be doing in different parts of the field. Very clever when it comes to first phase plays, be it from scrums and lineouts, and understanding how he wants to move his team around. But I think that ability to adjust your game, not just on a week-to-week basis, but also within a game, is something which he'll benefit from being in Munster. And I think that's his big learning. But he wants to learn. He's a very competitive man. Don't be fooled by his demeanour. He's very, super competitive. But he loves the game of rugby, and I know he's loving it. No, he and his family are loving it there in Munster, because he loves that community. It's an extension of where he's grown up in Australia.
Sounds good. Well, listen, George, we've enjoyed watching the career from afar. I guess Keith has seen it up close and personal. Thanks so much for coming on. Stay safe over the next few months. These are strange times, and thanks again for making time for us this evening.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.